In Toronto alone, an estimated 200,000 undocumented migrants live in fear of accessing health care because of their immigration status. An additional 20,000 government-assisted refugees arrive in Canada each year, facing administrative and cultural barriers to accessing health. Although it is well established that migrants to Canada tend to arrive healthier than the general Canadian population, many do arrive with complex healthcare needs compounded by stresses associated with migration. On today's episode of Health Justice Radio, we speak with Nike Rai, a member of the migrant justice organization Health for All.
Listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3.
Hi there, you're listening to the Health Justice Radio Collective. My name is Nikki Bosnoff, on the board is Eric Brown, and with us on the phone is Nike Rai. She's a Toronto-based community organizer and a graduate student at the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto. Her research interests include the political and economic determinants of migrant health and equitable access to primary health care and health care policy. She's also a member of the migrant justice organization Health for All. Hi, Nike.
Hi, Nikki. Thanks so much for having me here today.
So let's get right into it. Can you tell me a little bit about what Health for All is?
Yeah, so we identify as a migrant justice and health organization. So we're a group made up of migrants, healthcare professionals, students, activists, and allies. We believe health is a fundamental human right and a matter of social justice. So for us, health requires not only access to services for maintaining physical and mental health, but it also requires full economic, social, environmental, and political rights for all people. As an organization, we have three main demands, really. We call for access without fear, which means access to healthcare services without fear of what I like to call the four Ds. So fear of debt, denial of service, detention, or deportation. Our second major demand is health for all, which is universal health coverage for all people in Canada. And then our overarching and main demand is status for all, which is the full regularization of all people in Canada. And when we say status, we mean more broadly than the current definition of citizenship. So status for us means access to good jobs, housing, food, education, health care, and ultimately justice and dignity for all people.
So can you tell me about who we're talking about when we talk about people who don't have access? What are the kind of categories of migrants that exist in Canada?
Yeah, so we often like to think of it as, you know, citizens versus not citizens. But to help simplify all the different forms of status or migrant status, we've created five different categories. But before I share them, I think it's important to recognize that these are really this is for simplicity's sake, and these are fluid assignments because people are constantly being shifted between them. Another way to think about it is that people are strategically being kept out of obtaining full status, and by that we mean citizenship. So with that said, let me just go into it and explain the five major categories. Mm-hmm. So then there's the citizens. Then we have permanent residents. So citizens are, before I go into permanent residents, citizens are people who are either born here or migrants or individuals who have lived in Canada long enough to obtain citizenship status. Then we have permanent residents, and they come through two major channels into Canada. They can either come to the point system, which is really based on skilled work categories, and I think it should be recognized as a classist system geared towards admitting able-bodied, you know, middle-upper-class migrants with university education, and as Jason Kenney often says, they need to be able to speak English or French. And then the other category of permanent residents is a sponsored category, so this could be sponsorship either privately or through the government. Then we have refugees. So again, two major kinds of refugees. We have the government-assisted refugees. Often we'll hear the word GARs. And then we have refugee claimants or asylum seekers. I think today's radio show we're talking about Bill C-49, and this is really the group that's being targeted by that bill, but we'll go into that later.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the precarious status migrants. So under this, you know, there's the temporary foreign workers, so whether that be the seasonal agriculture workers or the live-in care workers. And these should also be declared as indentured servants, really, because their status, meaning their access to essential services, is dependent on their employer to a large extent.
Mm-hmm. So I guess some of our listeners might not know exactly how the temporary worker system works, so I wonder if we can break it down a little bit more.
Yes.
Who are these people?
So seasonal agriculture workers are people that are working in our farms. They're working for 6 months at a time in Canada, and they're going home. And then we have the live-in care workers. So these are live-in, they're nannies, they're taking care of our kids, they're taking care of houses and families, and they're here for a longer period of time instead of the cyclical way that the seasonal agriculture workers come in.
Mm-hmm.
And we can go into that more, I guess, in a little bit as well.
Okay.
Because they are also definitely being targeted by our immigration policies in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Other precarious status migrants, so student and visitor visas are also part of that. So, you know, students coming in through a student visa and also just visitors coming in for a chunk of time to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the denied refugee claimants who are applying for a humanitarian and compassionate application. So it's called the H&C application.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really the last resort to appeal for the denial of the refugee claim. So they are also part of the precarious status migrants because the government, it does know who they are and that they exist. And then the last category, which is the most precarious, I think if you see, we're going from citizens to permanent residents to refugees to precarious, and then finally to non-status migrants. So these are your undocumented migrants. They're denied refugee claimants. They're persons who've overstayed visitors, work, or student permits, and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So obviously, those people live in fear of accessing healthcare. But can you tell me a little bit about, you know, what kind of access under law each of these categories has?
Yeah. So most people are obviously aware of the citizens who have access to OHIP, but you require documentation, of course. So, i.e., like an address.
Mm-hmm.
So that excludes the homeless community from obtaining OHIP there. But then under the permanent residents. They undergo, within Ontario, and I'll keep it to Ontario because the provinces are slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
Under Ontario, they go through a three-month wait period. So for the first 3 months of their time in Canada, they do not have access to OHIP. And then refugees, the two categories that I'd said, the government-assisted refugees, actually come in with OHIP already. And then the refugee claimants actually have access to this program called the Interim Federal Health Program. It's a temporary medical coverage program that's administered through the federal government, not provincially,
mm-hmm.
and it gives access to essential and emergency medical, pharmacy, optical, and dental services,
mm-hmm.
And it's only valid for 12 months at a time, so you have to continually renew it. And if there's any healthcare providers listening to the show, there is a handbook available on the on the Citizenship and Immigration Canada website, the CIC website. As for the temporary status migrants, we have the foreign workers, who also, so these are the seasonal agriculture workers and the live-in caregivers.
Mm-hmm.
They undergo the three-month wait period as well before they can have access to OHIP. But under that three-month time, the employers are actually mandated to provide them with private insurance. But how that's enforced and how much of that actually happens is really quite precarious in the sense that a lot of these migrants do not have access in that first 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then even beyond that, I mean, if for foreign workers who are working on their either on their farms or in a home under the service of their employer, you can see the power dynamics and the challenges to even ask to go see a doctor when or see any kind of a clinic when they're feeling ill, when their bodies are really what's allowing them to stay at their work.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the visitor visa and work permits, and they do not have access to any kind of care through the government. So it's, you know, pay out of your pocket or buy private insurance if they have the means to do so. And then the student visa holders can have access to something called UTIP, which is a university and college specific health insurance. And it varies across whichever university you're at. And then we have the undocumented migrants who have no access to health insurance or health care coverage in Canada.
Mm-hmm. And so what would happen if they went into, say, an emergency room?
We've seen in media a bunch of examples of when that does happen. If they go into an emergency room, either they'll be provided with ad hoc services or They'll be given the immediate care necessary and then also billed with, you know, facilitation fees or, you know, the care fees of actually staying overnight in the hospital. And these add up. And so this is why, you know, fear of debt is also part of our demands. Because that is quite a dangerous thing to fall under.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of sums are we talking about here?
Sorry, repeat that again?
What kind of money are we talking about here? How much would it cost?
Well, I can talk to you about a few cases that we've seen. There was the example of Patricia, who was a 17-year-old female, and she had sickle cell anemia. And she actually went to the ER and was denied care. Mm-hmm. And she was undergoing a sickle cell crisis. This is someone who has no status in Canada. She's mm-hmm. undocumented. So then she was denied care unless she was able to pay a registration fee, which at this particular hospital was around $350, which, of course, she wasn't able to pay. Mm-hmm. So she actually sat in the waiting room until she became unconscious and they had to admit her. And then she was billed $10,000 in return.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so this is one range. And then there's, of course, being there was the other story of someone who was under the 3-month waiting period. She was a permanent resident who had come in, and she had come in with $1,600 and was 5.5 months pregnant and couldn't afford prenatal care. And had an emergency C-section while she was still under that 3-month waiting period and was billed $5,000 for having her baby, essentially.
Wow. So if people are in this 3-month waiting period, are they eligible after to get their expenses reimbursed?
Ideally, they are supposed to be, but this is a question that, you know, so Ontario, Montreal, and Vancouver are the ones who still have, and BC are the ones who still have this 3-month wait period.
Mm-hmm.
And from my understanding, actually, that 3-month waiting period is for them to show their loyalty to Canada so that they're not just coming here for medical tourism or whatever propaganda that the government often throws out for mm-hmm. justification for having this 3-month wait period. You know, it was introduced under the NDP in 1994 in Ontario. So, from my understanding, no, actually, I think that's something that they're charged with.
Hmm. Okay, so are there any other barriers that we might like to hear about that migrants face?
Yeah, I think a key barrier really is the denial of public health insurance through denial of the full immigration status. So this is why our call for health for all is so intrinsically linked with our call for status for all. And other barriers that I think I've already mentioned is a threat of detention and deportation in going and accessing healthcare services.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, threat of debt, you know, from registration fees, physician fees, investigation fees, and I can't even name you all the fees that I'm sure are out there.
Mm-hmm.
And then also there's refusal of care by frontline administrators and staff hospitals. There was the case of the young boy, 7-year-old boy, who was a refugee from Mexico, who was denied by Humber River Hospital in October 2nd of last year, 2009, because his mother refused to pay $650 up front. And they had IFH. They had this interim federal health program,
mm-hmm.
but their certificate had just expired because it's this one-year continual that you have to continue on applying for.
Mm-hmm.
So they were waiting for a new one. And, you know, so providers just being unfamiliar with the paperwork is just one of the ways that we're seeing people being denied and or being billed with large amounts of money.
Mm-hmm. And language barriers as well, I assume.
Yeah, exactly. So I think overall it's discrimination and racism as key barriers to people trying to access care. There's a whole host from language to cultural to so many other barriers. And then if we get into the social determinants of health, right, like if we get into thinking about health even more broadly than access to health care,
mm-hmm.
then affordable, decent housing, good food, all of these things are really just not accessible to migrants.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's been a lot of buzz in the news lately about Bill C-49.
Yeah.
Can you tell me what it proposes and who it targets?
Yeah. So our Prime Minister, the leader of the right-wing government, Stephen Harper, and of course Jason Kenney, who's a Minister of Citizenship, Immigration, and Multiculturalism, have proposed this new Immigration Act, which is called the Preventing Human Smugglers from Abusing Canada's Immigration System Act. which is Bill C-49. Mm-hmm. So essentially this gives Minister of Public Safety to declare any group of migrants, and they haven't defined what group means, so we're presuming two or more people making a refugee claim. Coming into Canada, they can deem them a smuggling incident if the examination to establish identity or determine their inadmissibility can't be conducted in a timely manner, and if they're suspected to have smugglers profited from the group's arrival, or there's criminal organizations or terrorist groups that were involved in the process. So again, really vague definitions, mm-hmm. and this can be on any mode of arrival, so land, air, water. And the government claims that this bill is about stopping smugglers bringing people illegally into Canada. Mm-hmm. But I think once I just, you know, cite out some proposals for those declared part of the smuggling incident, it becomes clear that this bill is an attack against asylum seekers, refugees, and it's only going to create more non-status migrants in Canada rather than those with full status. So as per your question, the proposal, once you're declared part of the smuggling incident, the refugee claimants would be detained mandatorily on arrival with no review for the first year, and they can be indefinitely detained if the minister declares identity cannot be determined. They're not permitted to apply for permanent residency status for another 5 years. They're not permitted to apply for family reunification for another 5 years, and they can't travel outside of Canada for at least another 5 years. After they're accepted as a refugee. Mm-hmm. And then they're not permitted to make an H&C application if their refugee claim is denied, and they're not permitted to appeal the decision by the Immigration and Refugee Board if the claim is denied. So, I mean, it is targeting asylum seekers and refugees, and it does have some implications for permanent residents as well, because the bill lowers the standards for detention upon reentry to Canada. So officers can detain individuals on pure suspicion that they committed an offense in another country or were part of any kind of terrorist organizing, whether or not they were convicted of it. Mm-hmm. But as for asylum seekers and refugees, any refugee who arrived after March 2009 can be declared a designated foreign national. And that's the language that they're using to be declared as part of a smuggling incident. And just bringing it back to March 31st, 2009, I think is a key point, because passengers on the Ocean Lady and the MV Sun C, which were both boats that arrived in Canada with Tamil migrants fleeing the conflict in Sri Lanka both last year and this year, could be designated under this act. And it's fairly clear that it's from that arrival, the boats of Tamil migrants, that they've initiated such a proposal. The issues go from, you know, detention without review, imposition of conditions for release of detention are totally unknown. Requirements for refugees to report to officers is part of the act, and this refugee claimants that are accepted will be required to report regularly to an officer and answer all questions in accordance with regulations to be later determined. You have no right to appeal if your refugee status is rejected. You can't travel. This just goes against many Canadian and international laws. Mm-hmm. And cancellation of refugee protection status, this is also another important part of it. If at any time in the five-year wait to apply for permanent residency, even if the permanent residency application process is underway, the government can revoke their refugee status based on the analysis that the refugee's country of origin is now safe. So it's just, I think bottom line is that it's giving ministers absolute power to call anyone a criminal, and this will just give rise to absolute corruption.
Mm-hmm. So if I understand correctly, for example, someone who has somehow purchased a fake passport, mm-hmm. and then with the assistance of a so-called smuggler, with that fake passport has come to Canada and then will claim asylum, that action of obtaining false documents would also put them at risk of not obtaining refugee status under this?
Yeah, and that's exactly the type of people they're targeting. For example, I think the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navé Pillay, warned against using terms like human smuggling in replace of migration, right? Like, we're mm-hmm. talking about people who are irregularly migrating, and then we're posing them with criminality, which just further stigmatizes migrants and encourages a climate of xenophobia and hostility against them. Mm-hmm. When this is people who are migrating for in search of physical and economic security by any means necessary.
Mm-hmm. So obviously this has an impact on health. Mm-hmm. So can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, I think that's a good question because often we cite a lot of legal violations of this bill, but we have to understand that the legal documents are put into place to maintain health and human rights. So, I mean, when we consider health more broadly to include social, economic, and political issues, I think that helps us better identify the kind of ill health consequences of this proposed bill. Mm-hmm. But basically, if this bill is passed, I think it'd create an immediate health crisis. Just recognizing that people applying for refugee status are some of the most vulnerable in our society, incarceration and denial of health services would only worsen their physical health, along with increase their levels of anxiety, stress, and all other forms of mental health issues that I probably don't even know about. Mm-hmm. And not to mention, of course, the psychological stress and economic hardships that people will have to undergo if they're made to wait for 5 years to be able to apply for permanent residency, to reunite with their families, and ultimately they won't be able to root themselves in our communities. This limits access to secure jobs, to basic social services, and it would really just be perpetuating and worsening the economic hardships that many immigrants and refugees are all too familiar with already in this country.
Mm-hmm. So we heard the Liberal Party speak out against this bill, I think, mm-hmm. last week. What's the status of it now?
So as of December 1st, all opposition parties, which is the Liberals, New Democrats, and Bloc Québécois, have stated publicly that they cannot support Bill C-49. Mm-hmm. However, Jason Kenney is pushing this bill through and wants it to go to a committee hearing to ask for amendments. And they're going to continue pushing this and see where it can go. And, you know, I was reading a news today on the BC Catholic. I guess this is a Vancouver-based newspaper. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Kenney is stating these polls apparently where that the 2/3 of Canadians said we should stop the boat in foreign waters and turn it back. This is in reference to the MV Sunsea, mm-hmm. Which implies that we could have used force. You know, over half said we should deport even those who are deemed to be refugees. So this is the thing that Kenney is quoting and then therefore justifying the progression of this bill. And though all three opposition parties have stated publicly that they're against it, I think this is something that we need to continually fight against because I don't think Jason Kenney is willing to stop on this one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So why is this happening now? It seems like Jason Kenney is, drumming up this all these scare tactics.
Yeah, no, you're completely right. And I remember thinking to myself, like, you know, the fact that a law has been proposed in Canadian Parliament that aims to arbitrarily jail refugees and asylum seekers, and we haven't seen a massive uproar from the public. And I think the answer really lies in the 2008 financial crisis and the economic recession that we're in. I think so since, you know, June at the G20, government leaders in Prime Minister Stephen Harper's words announced their deepened commitment to this age of austerity, which means, you know, translates into cuts to welfare, which we're already seeing with the special diet allowance, housing, shelters, health care, and other social benefits. So though these cuts are going to have a lasting effect on the health of many communities, I think in the aftermath of this crisis, where those with a lot of wealth, the elites or the dominant upper classes, have continued to get richer at the expense of those that are struggling. Just a new report came out by Canadian Centre for Policy and Alternatives that stated that Canada's richest 1% are making more of the gains from economic growth than ever before in recorded history of this country. So the privileged few who rank among the country's richest 1% are taking home 32% of all growth in incomes between 1997 and 2007. That's almost a third of all the income between these years. Mm-hmm. So, and I think it's even more important to note that not only are we going to see further cuts, what I think that leads, including the Conservative government, rather not have in the public consciousness is this idea of the redirection of funds. And what do I mean by that? Well, basically this past year we've seen the government purchase $9 billion worth of fighter jets in July. And then we also saw an announcement of $10 to $13 billion for new prison spending during a time when we're seeing the low crime rate in our country. Actually, when they announced the billion dollars for prison spending, just recently when I was reading that, it made me think about the reports that are coming out in relation to Arizona Senate Bill SB 1070 and the role that the private prison industry has played in drafting and helping win that bill.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me think of, you know, what are the possible motivations for pushing forward such a bill like Bill C-49?
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, like, what does all of this mean, right? I think as a result of this economic recession, we're seeing an increased scapegoating of migrants by the government and media. And this isn't something new. I think migrants and outsiders have been used as scapegoats for as long as I can remember.
Mm-hmm. I remember headlines from the Tamil ships from Jason Kenney that said that more boats are on the way, more boats are coming.
Yeah, yeah. When the Ocean Lady arrived in Canada with 76 Tamil migrants last year, the immigration minister, Jason Kenney, that you're talking about, and public safety minister publicly called the asylum seekers terrorists before they had even landed,
mm-hmm.
right? So over and over again, we're seeing that, you know, we were told that the migrants were breaking the law, that they're fleeing economic and military, you know, havoc doesn't come into play. The fact that this is how many people actually reach Canada through fake passports has been an ideal way of accepting refugee asylum seekers before.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that there's no queue for asylum seekers, we heard, you know, they're jumping the queue, they're breaking it, and they're exploiting our generous immigration system. The fact that people are allowed to apply when and if they show up in Canada somehow is strategically forgotten in that messaging.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All of this really makes me think about a key example from our history that helps illustrate the seriousness of this matter. Our conservative Minister of Citizenship and Multicultural is proposing this bill, but the unfortunate story of the shipload of German Jewish refugees aboard the SS St. Louis who were refused sanctuary in Canada and forced to return to Europe when they arrived in 1939. Most of them returned and perished in the Holocaust. And in 1995, we saw our former prime minister at the time agreed that Canada turned its back on these migrants aboard the SS St. Louis. So, you know, it is for this reason that I believe this act must be completely thrown out. Like,
mm-hmm.
we have to sincerely ask ourselves, how many more apologies are we willing to be issued in the future?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is a really important issue, and we just have a few minutes left, so I wonder if mm-hmm. you can quickly tell us about some of the action that's taking place in Toronto and in Ontario more broadly. What does the migrant justice movement look like right now?
Mm-hmm. So really briefly, I think the current migrant justice movement that Health for All is part of, with other lead organizations such as Known as Illegal, Education on Deportation, Shelter Sanctuary Status, we're all working towards building a sanctuary city, which really means it's not just about passing policies, but it's about creating a condition collectively where exclusionary immigration policies simply can't function in our cities. So it's pushing immigration enforcement out of every place where people can gather and gain access to essential services.
Mm-hmm.
So for Health for All, this means resisting and creating conditions necessary for access without fear in health centers and hospitals and university health programs where people work, study, and get services in. And I think it's important to highlight that the sanctuary city movement, it's not an end to itself. It's precisely because as communities of color, migrants, people, poor people, queer, and other marginalized communities, we're all too aware of the injustices in this city, and we all know too well the systems in place to shut us out from formal decision-making. So in a political and economic environment that is hostile to building and sustaining social justice, I think we're taking part in a grassroots community mobilization that creates cultural shifts from below. And this ultimately, in our minds, opens and creates new realities from below, leaving no choice for those in elected positions to follow and respond. Two key victories that I'd just like to plug in was the expanding access to education without fear, where the Toronto District School Board passed a policy that bars immigration enforcement from entering 558 schools that are under their jurisdiction here, and just the recently announced victory by Shelter Sanctuary Status, which had the immigration enforcement was pushed out of all anti-violence against women spaces across the GTA.
So, congratulations.
Yeah, and I think this is all just a significant victory towards mm-hmm. creating health for all, really.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's all the time we have for today, but thank you so much, Nike, for being with us.
Not a problem. Thanks so much for having me.
All right.
Bye,
Bye. We'll put the website for Health for All up, and we hope you'll take a look at it and take action against Bill C-49. Right now, we'll go to a song. It is Zeus, and How Does It Feel?